in Iraq. The interviewer is Marge May.
Could you tell us a little bit about you and how you became involved with the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq?
I was born in Baghdad, and I lived most of my life in Baghdad. Most of my education I got in Baghdad. I worked as an architect there. Then I obtained my master's in Baghdad. And in the year 1993, I traveled because it was no longer possible to live under the economic sanctions in Baghdad. I reached Canada in 1995 and stayed in Canada until 2003 when the war broke out. And that was the time that I decided to pack up and go back to Iraq. In Canada, I met some Iraqi people in exile. Some of them were women activists who had made a difference in the north of Iraq. They were active in the 1990s, and at some point they established a women's shelter in the city of Sulaymaniyah. For a few years they worked before the authorities closed it down for them. So I met these women here in Canada, and I was surprised at the amount of courage and at the ambitious work that they had done. And I thought maybe it is doable in Iraq after some change takes place.
May I interrupt you for a moment and ask you, why did the authorities close down the shelter?
There were a few reasons. First, they had a very ambitious project for women. They were speaking about full equality, and they had publicized that no woman has to surrender to her domestic abuse or to her ugly reality at home, that they will help her, they will provide her with the alternative, and that they had, at the time, between the years 94 and the year 2000, they have saved 254 women from either honor killing or domestic abuse, and it made a change in the tribal scene of Kurdistan, and it reached to the point where the authorities were not okay with it, because the situation was going somewhere where they were not having a hand in it. Some other opposition political groups were supporting the project. So the authorities, from one side, were not okay with the women becoming empowered and independent. And from another side, because the project was affiliated with opposition political groups, it was taken as a pretext and it was closed. And many women were sent in the streets. I'm speaking about women who were wanted for honor killing. And a few of them got killed eventually, but it was none of the concern of the authorities. So later on, what happens is that at this point, everybody says the situation of women in the Kurdish part of Iraq is much better. But nobody knows what the real story is, that there was a very brave women's group who has brought this change to the society. It wasn't the authorities. But now what happens is that the authorities claim it, and they bring a few of their women relatives, they open women's organizations for them, and they tell the whole world that this is how Kurdistan changed, that it had a good regional authority, a good government who took responsibility for the issue. You know, this is our life story in Iraq. The authorities have been all the way along, very oppressive, and always against the change, against the progressive change for society in general and the women in particular. And Kurdistan is not very different from the center and south of Iraq where Saddam's authorities prevailed. So this is the group of women that I met in Canada, and the name of their organization was Independent Women's Organization. It was kicked out of Kurdistan and they stayed in exile for such a long time, but the banning of their organization happened after being able to work for around, I would say, 8 years, which brought a big change to the society in that part of Iraq. Having met them, having seen what their experiments were like, gave me the idea that there should be a time when we should be planning this for the rest of Iraq. You know, Baghdad is a big city. It's somewhere between 5 and 6 million people. It is hard to compare it with the cities of Kurdistan, where the biggest city is not 1 million people in population. So it was clear that the project would have to be much more courageous, and it will have many more difficulties, but it was also very clear to me that it would have many supporters because, you know, I grew up in Baghdad and I know what the social setting is like, that a woman who wants to be strong, who wants to be supported, most of the people I personally know would support such a project. I remember the school, I remember the university, I remember the work. For me, I think if I compare it with many parts of the world, at the time when I grew up, it was one of the best settings for a girl. And at school, we had the full opportunity to prove ourselves. In the university, I remember that the number of girls in my class were more than the boys. And those who had better grades were almost more than the males. And later in the master's, we were all paid a salary to finish our education. And after finishing education, we were automatically recruited to our work, which some of us did not like and preferred to work in the private sector like myself. But you know what? We had there for us the opportunities in education, at work. Socially, I would say some of the issues were not really there. But there was a big opposition socially from women, from people. Under Saddam, of course, it wasn't possible to organize publicly for it. But the society wasn't one that would surrender for tradition and want a woman to be weak and unsupported. All the people that I remember, from my memory, I said yes, they would support. Well, like the shelters that we have set in Iraq, or the organization that we had in mind to make in Iraq.
So, you know, you're describing your experiences living in Baghdad?
Yes. Most of my life I spent in Baghdad. For a few years I had to leave Baghdad at a very young age, just like many Iraqis. You know, Iraq is a very highly politicized society, and you rarely find, let's say, for a middle-class family where the father and the mother have both have degrees, you usually have them politically involved in one scene or another. So because my father was at some point in the 50s, he was involved with a leftist party, we had to leave the country for a few years and come back later. So other than that, all of my life I was living in Iraq, and the reason I emphasize this is that many groups try to say that I bring Western ideas and try to apply them in Iraq. Well, the answer to that is there was a big group of progressive women in Iraq that were affiliates of leftist parties who had organized 45,000 women in Iraq in the late 50s. And they had done so much women activism work as a pressure group that had influenced the society in Iraq and also the legislation. So we are not speaking about a society where there was no knowledge of women's rights, where there was no organizing of women's groups, and there were no strong women behind it. And I was very young at the time, but, you know, we're hearing it from my parents, from the relatives, and living as a teenager in a place where I was able to wear modern dress, I was able to mix with the other sex, and we were living a good life. So to go back to Baghdad after this war breaks out and to see what the women now in this day are living like, this was big trauma for myself, just like many women. And I'm speaking about myself. I have left Iraq only for 10 years. But these last 10 years were dramatic in the sense that the U.S. policies against our country had brought around major changes. We are speaking about the War of the Desert Storm, where all the allies attacked a country of 25 million and bombed heavily and killed 150,000 people. We are speaking about an embargo, the economic sanctions, which has impoverished millions of people, where many of the strong women that I used to know, my colleagues at work and my neighbors in the residential area, I go back and I see them after 13 years of sanctions and after two of the heaviest wars in the area, I see them different women. I see them wrapped up in black from top to bottom. I see them covering the head when they were very modern and very libertarian women. So some people say, yes, that area has been religious all its life. But that's not the answer. The answer is that the U.S. policies imposed on Iraq in the last decades, I would say 2.5 decades, have turned the people helpless, weak, hopeless, and with nowhere to turn to but to religion and to, I don't know, maybe superstition, maybe just staying quiet and locked up in your home because you're just afraid from the worst to come.
You're listening to Yanar Mohammed, chair of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. The interviewer is Marge May.
When did you go back, Yanar?
Immediately after the war. It took me a couple of months to reach there. Actually, to tell you the truth, although I had the idea of setting up an organization there, still it was not easy to take the first steps. There was this telephone call from a friend inside Baghdad. He told me about the streets, what they look like. He told me, Yanar, no woman dares to go out in the streets. If she goes out, she is being kidnapped, she is being trafficked, she is being raped, and nobody is saying anything about it. So the situation needs a serious women's group who would advocate the issue, who would scandalize what has happened to the women because of this war. He told me some of you women really need seriously to consider coming here and setting an organization. I told him it will take me 2 weeks to get my ticket and arrange all my situation around me, and you will see me there, and let's talk to the other women too. So we set up this organization. By the end of May 2003, I was there. Another colleague of mine, a woman from Kurdistan, joined me. She was the one who had started the organization that had opened the shelters in the northern part of Iraq. Actually, we sat down together, myself and herself, and we spoke about what name we want to give to this organization. So many names came into our minds. So in the end, we agreed about the word freedom, because as a concept and as a goal, that is what we want to achieve. She told me the name organization, the word has to be there, and freedom has to be there, woman has to be there, and we prefer usually not to use Iraqi woman. We usually prefer to use in Iraq, because for us, we are not nationalistic people. We are more international people, and we think that the geography for us is just a coincidence of where we are, and women, wherever they are in the world, they should be defended. So there we came up with the name Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. In June 22 of 2003, we made our founding event, and we announced it to all the people who were present. And I had started the newspaper. At the time, it was more like a newsletter. It's called Al-Musawat, which means equality. And it was very hard to conceive that in Iraq you have a woman's newspaper that says, that has slogans in big font written, no to compulsory veil, and our demands are a secular egalitarian constitution. So when we printed at the time 3,000 copies and we distributed them in a few cities, you wouldn't believe how much it caused commotion all over these cities. It actually stormed in a situation where nobody dared to speak about their security, about safety, and there comes this women's group who wants full equality and nothing else. You know, for us, many people would tell us it's something to achieve in the future. You cannot think of it right now. There are many other priorities. For us, that was not the case. We thought if other groups were ambitious enough to change the whole dictatorship, if other groups were ambitious enough to claim all our lives and impose on us a life that doesn't belong to us, we are also ambitious enough to claim what was ours in the first place, although it wasn't good, it wasn't complete, but we have to keep it and we have to improve it, and nothing less than full equality.
Yanar, how do you view the current government in Iraq? While it is mandated that a certain percentage of women participate in the government, do you think this government can really support the values that you are promoting?
Well, I'll answer gradually. I'll speak about the first thing, about this government and how it was set up. Since the beginning of our stay in Baghdad, and although we had spoken to the authorities at many times, we reached to the conclusion that if we do not identify ourselves using our ethnic IDs and our religious IDs, we are not considered by the occupation powers. And we were expecting it because even before the breaking out the war, the occupation of Iraq, in some of the exile conferences that were run in the West, one of them was the London conference, no Iraqi living in exile was accepted into that conference unless he or she accepts to take a seat that is given to a certain ethnicity or a religion. Some people wanted to join under political affiliations. They were denied access. So that policy had been working in Iraq since day number one. We were not given any importance because we spoke about women's rights. All the importance was given to ethnic groups, nationalist groups, and religious groups. And at the times when we spoke, I spoke personally to a couple of the women's, they call them the gender responsible or the women's issues responsible in the CPA. And I told them that we do not agree to what's happening in Iraq. At the time, there was an interim constitution, and it was still based on the old issues of basing the constitution on religion, where the woman is not equal, the woman is not equal to the man. We told them this inequality cannot continue in the constitution or in the law, and there will need to be some amendments, especially for some articles of the law that are not acceptable. For example, there's this article 409 in Criminal Code 111 that supports honor killings. And honor killings is when a tribe prefers to keep the honor of a tribe but kills the woman because she has been doing something that was unallowed by the tribe in her personal life. So we went to the authorities, and at that time the authorities were directly the CPA, which means the American and the British people in charge. And we told them that this amendment needs to take place because otherwise women will be second rate in this country and any man can kill any woman and claim that she was honorless. But you know what? At the time, we were not given answers. One of the British women in charge gave me an answer and told me, why don't you speak to the head of your tribe and see if you can gain his support? So, you know, for myself coming from a country with very long history in women activism, I found that very strange, that this so-called liberation of Iraq does not support a woman activist but prefers to support the tribal heads, prefers to support the ethnic and nationalist groups, and we all know where those groups will take Iraq someday. They will balkanize Iraq, and they were willing to support all the religious groups, but none of the radical women's groups, they would support Islamic women's groups, a group that promotes the veil, a group that promotes that women succumb and surrender to the patriarchal values. But for OWFI and our values of full equality, that would maybe disturb the status quo or make them oppose their classic supporters of tribal heads and ethnic heads and religious heads. They were not okay with that. So we have been living 2 years of witnessing a political formula put in place that would divide people upon their ethnicities, upon their religions, and not giving the women's issue any importance at all. The only procedure that they took was the 25%. Of course, this came after the pressure of local women's groups, but those women's groups were affiliates of the government. Still, there was a pressure, and they put this 25% of quota of the government in place. And what is the result eventually? In this last election that was neither honest nor free, the 25% of the women who reach, and it's more than 25, it's around 30%, half of those women who have arrived to parliament come from religious parties, and namely Islamic parties, who do not believe in the equality of women to men. And all of those women would vote yes for replacing our civil code with an Islamic Sharia that equals one man to four women socially, and equals one man to two women economically, and politically speaking, a woman is already considered inferior. Even if she is put in the better positions, still the man sitting next to her would know better.
I'd like to ask you another question. You describe certainly a very desperate situation in terms of what's happening socially and politically in Iraq for women. What about the reconstruction, so-called, of Iraq? And can you discuss the lack of basic services such as water, sanitation, electricity, health care in relation to the situation that women face in Iraq today?
Yeah, there is one very dominant factor of the total lack of electricity. Of water is a little bit better, but there's also a lack from time to time, and gas. And the reason for that is that this government that has been put in place, the people do not feel that it represents them in any way. And the resistance, the so-called resistance, we are no supporters of this terrorist political Islam resistance, but this resistance has been fighting the U.S. invasion and the Iraqi government in a way that is devastating for the people, not for the government itself. I'll give you examples here. In the areas where we live in Baghdad, whenever the electricity, the generators get fixed and they are up and working and we have more electricity, in a few days, the generator gets exploded again and we are left without electricity again. And this happens over and over again. You wouldn't believe how many times these generators all over the city were exploded were reached to the degree that we became hopeless. And you know what can make you happy if you are in Iraq at this moment? The thing that could make you happy is to have electricity in your house and water reaching to your house, like you open the tap and there's water coming out. And you know that you can fill your car with gas or get enough fuel to do the cooking that day. It reached to the situation where you have no hopes of guaranteeing your life for a month or two, no hope of having a political representation that you are proud of, that represents you. You have reached to the level where just having electricity would be enough for you. So that's the level of expectations of people in Iraq now.
What needs to happen in your wildest, best dreams to facilitate peace and return to an environment in Iraq in which women feel safe and able to care for themselves and for their families and able to express themselves and participate fully.
We cannot have a good life living under a theocracy. That is a major requirement, that the government is non-ethnic, non-nationalist, and also non-religious, and the constitution itself needs to be a secular, egalitarian constitution. Because we know in many countries you could have a secular constitution, but then again, it's not egalitarian, it does not equal women to men. The patriarchal values would still be prevailing. So if we are speaking about political formula, this is the basic requirement. And we know very well that under the occupation, we cannot have that. Because the U.S. Troops and administration have come to Iraq with one sole determination that Iraqis are a bunch of ethnic groups, nationalist groups, and religious groups, that politics do not fit in and cannot be used as IDs, and this has started a civil war already. We are divided because we are Arab, Kurd, Turkmen, and even seats in the government we're assigned to these divisions. We are being divided because we are Muslim, Christian, or other religion. What needs to come in place is a group or a mentality that tells people you are all equal, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of religion. And that's what my group is working for. We are working to open a radio station where we tell everybody that you are equal. Let's work together to make this society an egalitarian, a free, and a modern place. There are a few good progressives, and let's call them people who want the best for the country. They're called, their coalition is named Iraq's Freedom Congress. They have put their hands in our hands. We are making this radio station together, and we are beginning these gatherings where people have to take matters into their hands. Unfortunately, this government does not represent us, and we have to come up with our own solution. And meanwhile, as we are watching and waiting for the better to come, the civil war has already broken out in Iraq. So for a woman to live in better times in Iraq, first you need security, then you need a constitution that respects all and equals them all, and people will need to be represented.
Yanar Mohammed, chair of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, speaking to Marge May of Community Radio WERU-FM in 2005. Find current activities of the organization, including their shelter, school, newspaper, and radio programs, on the website owfiraq.org. That's owfiraq.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Bird Note. Black swifts are extraordinary birds. They spend most of their lives in the air and migrate thousands of miles every year. But researchers have found that their lifestyle is even stranger than we once knew. Scientists placed lightweight tracking devices on swifts nesting in Colorado. This let them study their movements once they reached their wintering grounds in Brazil. This provided unprecedented access to the swifts' world in the skies. Astonishingly, black swifts spent over 99% of their time in the air during the winter, almost never touching the ground for months. What's more, the swifts flew to incredible heights, reaching the highest altitudes on nights when the moon was full, sometimes over 13,000 feet. It's the first time scientists have seen birds changing their altitude along with the cycles of the moon. It's still unknown why the moon seems to draw black swifts high into the sky. It's possible that insects, many of which can also fly thousands of feet in the air, are attracted to the moon, and swifts follow their insect prey upward. What is clear is that these birds have abilities beyond what our eyes can see. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.